Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When people first come into our lives, it's impossible to know how important they'll become. Leah Keith writes about a man who came to matter a great deal to her. Her essay is titled, Despite the Losses, So Much Gained. It's read by Marcia Stephanie Blake, who's just been nominated for an Emmy Award for her performance in the Netflix drama When They See Us.
Dude was a doctor who wanted to leave medicine. We met almost 20 years ago when he applied to a writing fellowship program at the movie studio where I was an executive. When I called him with the good news, he jumped up and down and screamed into the phone. Then he told me he didn't hear anything after the word accepted. To me, he said, you just sound like an angel. No one had ever called me an angel before. Months later, Dude moved to Los Angeles. In the beginning of our professional relationship, I would give him notes on his screenplays. Our personal relationship happened later. I was a 26-year-old black woman from Georgia, and he was a New York Italian, 13 years older. I don't remember when or why he became Dude, but after the naming, he anointed me Lily, short for Lil Dude. From then on, we were those people to each other. Dude loved biking, hiking, and anything I cooked. I loved Pilates, Arctic martinis, and anything he wrote. We sang, we danced, we watched movies and debated their merits. We read to each other before falling asleep. Our relationship was not an obvious one, but neither of us liked the obvious. Dude smelled like freshly folded laundry, baked chicken, red wine, and loaves of bread as they rose in the oven. He said my smile lit up a room. Waiting for success was not easy for Dude. Achieving a number one ranking in his Ivy League graduating class had been effortless compared with selling a screenplay. I tried to explain that in Hollywood, success equaled talent plus luck. But he didn't understand. And I couldn't understand why he didn't understand. We argued. It felt like the beginning of the end for us. Dude broke up with me before leaving for the airport to bury his father. The phone call was as sudden to me as his ailing father's death had been to him. I told myself I had pushed him too hard. I told myself I wasn't this or that enough. I told myself he just didn't love me as much as I loved him. Eventually, time brought on the occasional check-in phone call. I learned that to make ends meet, Dude took an administrative assistant job at a Hollywood studio. It's better than staring into a microscope for hours, he said. Hollywood, for him, had lost its luster. He was no longer writing, but he also had no interest in returning to medicine. I knew that I, as his marginally successful producer former girlfriend, had become a reminder of the only defeat he had ever known. I feigned excitement about his new job. I didn't want to know much about his dating life, and he didn't seem curious about mine. Calls became less frequent, and dinners happened only at birthdays. But when we were together, we laughed, ate, drank, and sang as we always did. Then we returned to our separate lives. Everything changed 2 years ago, when my ear began to ring. I was awaiting a green light on an animated film. The ringing was loud and constant. I called Dude. After a hearing test, CT scan, and MRI, my life turned into someone else's movie. Dude said he would come with me to get the results. I didn't stop him. I was found to have a 2.5-centimeter acoustic neuroma, a benign tumor of the nerve connecting the ear to the brain. It occurs in about 2 of every 100,000 people. Unbeknown to me, I had already experienced 50% hearing loss in my right ear, and my facial nerve had been engulfed by the tumor. Removing it would be difficult. Half of my face could become paralyzed. This was highly specialized surgery, and my doctor said I was blessed because the best surgeon was only 15 minutes away. He was the Michael Jordan of neurotology. I could feel Dude trying to contain his excitement about meeting his heiress of the ear and brain. I gave him permission to geek out. I figured someone should be happy about something. After the appointment with MJ, Dude and I walked silently. Once we arrived at my car, I broke down. Dude held me. I was scheduled for a trans-labyrinthine craniotomy, the most conservative approach. I would be deaf in one ear, but if MJ was as good as everyone said, I would still have the smile Dude had once loved. The movie I was producing was going into storyboards. During that time, Dude and I talked on the phone every night until I fell asleep. In my doubting moments when I asked if we were doing the right thing, Dude would say, "We have the best surgeon. We chose the right surgery. We will be fine." I liked that he used the word "we." In my darkest moments, when I asked if he would still love me if I lost half my face, he said, "Hell no. Deformed people make me nervous. So if Lily's face gets busted, Dude out." We laughed, and then the man whose constant reply to my "I love you, Dude" had always been "ugh," said, "I will always love you, no matter what happens. Here is your medical directive," said the hushed-toned woman on the other side of the table. Dude had joined me at 8:30 a.m. at the hospital, where I signed enough paperwork to buy a house. My mother and sister had flown in and waited outside the door while Dude and I handled the grimmest of business. Dude wouldn't allow me to read the medical directive. He turned it over to the signing page and placed his hand over the words. "Sign," he said. I did as told, but not before I turned to him and said, "Don't pull the plug too soon. I'd like to become a Lifetime movie." He smiled and nodded. That was all we said about the fact that I could die that day. My mother called Dude her son, and my sister referred to him as her brother from another mother. We had become an unconventional family. "Who ordered a pizza pie?" were the first words I heard from Dude as he entered my hospital room the next day, carrying my dinner over his head. I smiled broadly. He smiled back even broader. I knew that he smiled because I could smile. The next days were filled with wobbly steps, tightly held hands, and many firsts. After I got home, Dude and I continued our pre-op ritual with almost nightly phone calls. 13 months after my diagnosis, on an ordinary Tuesday in November, we talked for hours. He spoke of his love of James Brown and his longing for forbidden foods like bacon and foie gras. He made me ask Siri on my new iPhone to do pornographic things to him. We laughed until I fell asleep. The next day, Dude's worried assistant, he was running the department now, called to say he hadn't shown up for work. When I arrived at his apartment, the paramedics were leaving. Dude had died. He'd not been ill. He had not had an accident. His heart had just done its work. I held on to a railing, and a paramedic sat with me until my world stopped spinning. I knew once I entered the apartment, life would be forever divided. Before Dude and after Dude would preface everything. The police arrived. There were interviews, phone calls, and a 3-hour wait for the coroner. During it all, I stood behind the kitchen counter, staring at the back of Dude's always pristinely blow-dried head. Soon, I would have to call his friends and family and divide their lives, too. Now Dude lives in photographs, one voicemail, one piece of video, one pair of hiking boots, his favorite jacket, a few worn sweatshirts, his watch, his cat, his screenplays, his copper pots and pans, his surgical instruments that he used to fry chicken, and the recesses of my memory. I will never again hear him explain that Miller Genuine Draft 64 only has 64 calories as justification for why it's okay to drink a six-pack in one sitting. I will never hear him explain every stage of the Tour de France in a way that makes me wish I could ride a bike. I will never know that he is hanging on to my every word when I tell him some ridiculous story about my day, and I will never again hear him laugh at that story. When my rare tumor was found, I thought it was the worst thing that could ever happen to me. Now I know I was the luckiest woman in the world. For 13 lucky months, I got to stare into the abyss and feel safe jumping into it because a man who loved me promised to hold my hand all the way down. If I had known that I would be the one who had to let go, would I have done anything differently? No.
That's Marcia Stephanie Blake reading Leah Keith's essay, Despite the Losses, So Much Gained. We'll hear more from Leah after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Leah Keith had her surgery in January of 2011. Dude died in November of that year. Leah went into grief counseling, and her last piece of homework was to write a goodbye letter to Dude.
I took it really seriously because I had a feeling that it was going to be the thing that sort of pulled me out of the pain. And so as I read the essay to the grief counselor, I guess there was a point at which she says that my expression changed, and she said, what was that? And I said, I think I just wrote a modern love essay. And I said, I think there's some value in this for other people and that I should put it out into the world, but I don't think I'm able to do that now. So I made a date for myself, 1 year, put it on my calendar, and I gave myself the year to heal. And on the designated date, I actually sat down and started to write. The thing that emerged from all the little anecdotes and quirks about him and funny little tidbits was that I was grateful, and that gratitude in times of pain became a resounding message that I really wanted to say to other people who were having a horrible year like I did.
These days, Leah's health is good. And when she looks back on the year she writes about, one of the times she's most grateful for, and that she remembers often, is the half hour before she was taken into surgery. Dude came with her to the prep room.
As we sat there, I literally remember shaking. And it wasn't because the room was cold. It was adrenaline. And he held my hand, and he said, "Stop shaking." And he made me laugh. And the next thing I knew, he was singing to me. And he was making up some stupid song. And the fellow came over to talk to me about shaving my head. And we had a whole hilarious exchange with him about how much hair to shave. And it was just silly. He took me completely out of my fear and my pain and just made the moment really resonate for me as something that was truly, I would not have made it through that 30 minutes.
When she was standing in Dude's apartment after his death, Leah thought about those 30 minutes again.
I was there with the police and people being interviewed and people coming and going and waiting for the coroner and all these sort of horrible, grim things. But I just kept thinking about that moment and how he was so present for those 30 minutes. And I was the most important thing to him in that moment, that I had to do that for him. So it actually gave me the strength to do all the practical, awful things that I had to do in that time, because I was like, well, you kind of did it for me. And I guess, you know, it's on me this time to do this for you.
Leah says that after Dude's death, the grief counseling helped. But the first few years were very difficult. And since then, she's experienced more loss.
Unfortunately, since he passed, I lost my father. I lost my dog of 15 years that he was good friends with. And I lost another really, really close friend. And all of those things were horrible. What I can also tell you is that in experiencing the other losses, you know, grief doesn't come compartmentalized. That horrible pit of the stomach feeling that you get when someone you love is gone, and particularly suddenly, just shows up. So it's compounded by every person you've lost. My father and my dog and my friend that passed were all people that he adored. So I felt like he was in the grief with me and consoling me and protecting me, and I knew I would get through it.
One of the ways that Leah remembers Dude is by keeping his possessions around her.
I'm wearing his watch today because I thought he'd like to be in the room and give me a little guidance as I talk to you. I keep his stuff around a lot. You know, it helps. It makes me feel protected. It makes me feel like he's around. He had a little bit of an obsession with copper pots and pans, and I cook in them every day. You know, I find that on certain days when I have meetings or events or things that I need just a little bit of fortifying for, and I might be a little nervous, I might wear his watch that day, or I might, you know, wear a shirt of his or something. My friends laugh because whenever I'm looking for parking, I call on him. And I'm like, okay, hook me up. And sure enough, there it is. What I really want people to take away from my story is when you're in those moments where you're kind of getting beaten down, to take a moment in when you're in the midst of it, for as awful as it is, and try to find something to be grateful for. It's oftentimes really, really, really hard to find, and you can't necessarily find it right when you're in it. But if at some point you can, I really think that clinging to that thing is what allows you to step out of the dark.
That's Leah Keith. She's a screenwriter, producer, novelist, and essayist. She lives in Los Angeles. More from Dan Jones and Marcia Stephanie Blake after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, has read thousands of essays. But he says that even he was surprised by the turn that Leah's essay took.
You know, you think you're headed down one road with health problems for Leah, and then suddenly Dude, whose name I love, dies within one sentence in a totally unexpected way, and the story becomes about something else. It was just a story that was full of unlikeliness, you know, the unlikeliness of them together and of how they become each other's most important person in a way, and how you never really know who's going to be the cared for and the caregiver and what losses will happen when. But it was just well written and with surprising sense of humor and this pairing that just skated along the surface a lot of the time in terms of how they spoke and how they bantered, but had so much depth to it and so much, in the end, commitment to each other that I just really found that sort of a moving and surprising love story.
And here's Marcia Stephanie Blake.
I love that it was filled with humor and friendship, and I could relate on so many levels with the loss in terms of the career and also in terms of the relationship. It made me laugh, it made me cry.
Thanks again to Marcia Stephanie for reading this week's essay. She's just been nominated for an Emmy for her performance in When They See Us. Next week, Miriam Shore.
Anita and I met 5 years ago as roommates at a hospital just outside of New York City. According to the brochure in our patient intake folders, the hospital's scenic grounds boasted rolling lawns, open meadows, forests, and a gazebo. But why would we care about the landscaping? The brochure reminded me of a commercial I had seen for Hulu while watching Hulu. We didn't need an advertisement for the hospital. We were locked inside.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Our intern is the wonderful Shemi Oloko, who is going back to campus next week. So, Shemi, we're going to miss you a lot and your terrific work. Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music courtesy of APM. And if you love the podcast, go ahead, give us a rating or review us on Apple Podcasts. And even better, tell a friend to subscribe. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.